The following podcast is part of a special oral history program titled The RSL, A Time to Celebrate. The program documents fascinating and personal stories and experiences of veterans across South Australia. The program received funding through the Veteran and Community Grants stream in partnership with the Tanunda RSL sub-branch and the Emu Tree, and was produced by Christian Teusner. I encourage listeners to take their time to explore as many of these stories and adventures as possible. For further information, visit www.theemutree.com. Okay, it is the 18th of May. I'm here in Port Pirie with Jeff Kenyon. Jeff, can I just get you to state your full name, your date of birth, and your service number, please?
Jeffrey Ronald Kenyon. I was born the 4th of the 1st, 1945, and my service number is 4717627.
Thank you, Jeff, for participating in this program. This is the RSL Time to Celebrate. And can I ask you, please, just to tell me a little bit about where you're from, where you were brought up, etc. A bit of family history.
I was born in Port Pirie, lived here all my life, except for the 2 years I spent in the army, and I come back here and went to the waterworks to work for 3 months, and then I went to the PASMINC or BHAS smelters, lead smelter, and I stayed there until I retired in year 2000 through ill health.
Any stories, any fond thoughts, memories of growing up here at Port Pirie?
Oh, we used to get up to mischief all the time growing up. We'd go out, hop on the bikes and go out rabbiting or anything else like that, stay out overnight. Didn't have to go very far to get the rabbits those days. We weren't allowed to anyway. Mother ruled with an iron fist. I grew up, I suppose, when I got up to 18, 19, I was still a mum's boy. And when I come home, I returned home and lived our own home until I was 26. That was when I come out of the army. My mother reckons the army was the ruination of her dear little boy, but her dear little boy thought it was the making of him.
Did you grow up in a big family?
Three of us, a brother and a sister. I was a national serviceman. I was in the first intake. I got in by 4 days. How'd they feel? My mother, who had been through World War II, she was very scared of what would become and what would happen. The brother and sister, they more or less just took it in their stride that if something else was happening. Until I come home, and it even struck home with them when I come home on final leave, embarkation leave, when I come home and tell them I was heading overseas, within a fortnight they got very worried then. But I've got to say, of all the time I was there, I had their support.
What age were you when you were called up?
I was 20 when I was called up, when I first went in the army. 21 when I went overseas.
Can you tell me a little bit about your training regime?
The first 3 months we were at Pakapunyal. All the sergeants and everyone, they were very nice when we lined up at Keswick Army Barracks. When we got off the plane to go to Pakapunyal, the nicest stopped and welcome to army life. And from then on, it was 3 months of hard work. Marching, learning how to march, going on 20-mile treks just to get us fit. We done that quite often. The part I hated about all of it was the parade ground stuff. I was definitely not a parade ground soldier.
How many hours a day would that involve?
We were up before sun up. Up, shower, dressed, tidy up the bedroom or our sleeping compartment, and breakfast by about 7 o'clock in the morning. think it was, or could have even been earlier, and then to the morning parade, and go about your business, whether it's rifle training, marching, whatever, and then you'd finish around sunset or just before. I think my fondest memory was the second night in at Pakapunyal. We had it all lined up at our great new underdacks that the army supplied, and great coats, and all lined up, marched over to the medic centre and had needles. And not just one, all that we needed for the time we were in. And I reckon there was at least six or seven of them all at once. In the arm, yes. There was no bend over and get one there. And it was marvellous to see how many of these tough young men there were that went down when they were having needles. I wasn't one of them. Yes. I would have been very embarrassed if I had gone down. It's hard to remember these days because it was over 50 years ago. I reckon there would have been close to 50 in each section or each platoon at that stage for training purposes. Lots of companies. I can't really remember, but there was a lot of people. Pakapunyal was more or less built for to house National Service people. There was an army camp there, but they enlarged Pakapunyal for the National Service training.
So within each, you're separated into different cabins?
Yes.
Or different barracks?
Yes.
Into smaller groups, smaller subgroups?
From, there was usually three sections to a platoon. I can't remember all of it, but we used to go out in platoon strength to train. So that lasted for 3 months, and we were given a weekend's leave, I think, in that 3 months. I think they kept us away from any leave whatsoever so that we could be accustomed to army life and the rules and regulations, which we got to know pretty well because you never walked over the Sergeant Major's parade ground. You either marched or walked around.
What would happen if you went across?
Your ears would be ringing for the next week. The Sergeant Major, if he saw you, go crook, and you'd end up probably on parade again and made march everywhere for the next week. His parade ground was his temple.
So you mentioned a date a moment ago when you went in.
Yes.
Can you just tell me what those dates were?
1st of July 1965.
That was 3 months?
Approximately 3 months. I think it was in September we went to, we were transferred to our units. Different units, or I was in infantry, I volunteered for infantry because I knew quite well that's what I was going to get. I wasn't disappointed that way, but they went out to all different areas. We had to drive up to Sydney. It was either drive or take the train, and I had my car there, so drove with three other people up to Sydney. You went over, you could have a drink at night time if you wanted, but That was about all. You go over to the mess hall and they had a canteen there where you could buy some alcohol. Of course, South Australians were probably cheap drunks because in those days you weren't allowed to have a drink of alcohol until you was 21. You weren't allowed into hotels or anything until you're 21. And in Victoria it was 18. So
how did that feel?
Liberating. We're men.
What was next in
the after program. Our initial 3 months, we went on to Sydney to Holsworthy Army Barracks, which we'd done our unit training as in infantry. And we'd done everything according to what infantry men do. During that time, we had camps at Canungra, Queensland. A month at Canungra, went to Gosford. And there was another place there, up there, very cold and that. But we, at the round, night time, you'd go out and do navigational skills and everything. And out camping in the bush, which I enjoyed because I more or less grew up in the country. Well, I did grow up in the country and I loved being out in the bush.
Do you look back on this point in time now with fond memories?
I do. I enjoyed my time in the army. I've got to say that. I can't say I enjoyed 12 months in Vietnam too well, but there was times in Vietnam we enjoyed. But my time overall in the army, I thoroughly enjoyed, even though I don't think I would have made much of a soldier in the end, because I was too argumentative at times. Yeah, well, you're growing up, you're experiencing things, new things. Mm-hmm. If you come from a country town, there's only certain things you can do. Our night enjoyment in Port Pirie on a Saturday night was hang out down Alexander Street, where all the milk bars were. We're allowed to go to hotels, but you're allowed to go to the milk bars and dances.
Good memories of the dances?
Oh, yes. Yes, well, you met young ladies there. You were, if you wanted to have a drink of beer and it was illegal, so that was exciting, you weren't allowed to go within 300 metres of the dance hall. And I can remember once when me and a mate come home from the army, we were sitting 199 metres, I think, away from the dance hall, drinking in the car, having a drink, and the person behind us was sitting on the bottom of his car having a drink. The police got him and left us alone. So I thought that was great.
That was really policed.
Yes.
It was really strict. Really hard to imagine.
Yeah. People of today wouldn't be able to understand the things that happened in that day and age, because we're so relaxed in our attitudes these days compared to what they were in those days.
Now, how much more training did you have to do before?
We done all from September until we went away in May. It was all training. Canungra was jungle training. They were supposedly using live rounds there as well, so you know the sound, live rounds going over your head. And that they made you pretty well up to date. I'd say we were well trained soldiers by the time we were ready to sail. Or when I say sail, we flew over, our company flew over, but the rest come by HMAS Sydney, the troop ship. I think we were well trained. I think we were well trained. You can't be trained enough to know how you'll feel or how you'll react when you first come under fire, enemy fire. But you, if all the training stayed in you, it was really, you know, you'd trained into it, you'd react to how you was trained. I can say the first time my nose hit the ground, it was dead fast. We were come back from a camp. This is funny, even though we got ambushed. We were out on operations. We come up to this creek, and on the other side, there was smoke. So they sent out a section of men out to check it out, and it was the enemy, the Viet Cong. So they must have heard or seen there was a couple of shots fired, and they took off. They were having tea. So we ended up with their tea, which was lovely rice, how it was cooked, and we ate that. Next day we troop back and we get to where we were waiting for the other two platoons, and we come under heavy fire. The same people must have followed us back there and caught up to us, paid us back for a pinch of their tea. I reckon, you know, when you think of it that way, it's funny, but Jesus, scared me a lot. That was our first action.
And what sort of sounds and senses and feelings and emotions were you going through experiencing this for the first time?
There's no sound like it than to hear live shots coming past you very quickly. You can't imagine it, what it's like. They always said that if you hear the crack, you know you haven't been hit, but it's very close that round. Well, I didn't really hear a crack that time, but where I'd been sitting on a tree log, there was several grooves taken out of the tree log. So I got behind a tree, a bloody big tree too. This happened very quickly, but if you're setting an ambush, it's sit or lay and wait to see if enemy come out or come through. It can be very long. You could be in ambush position all night and you've got to stay awake all night lying there. I think that's one of the hardest things that I had to do was laying there in ambush and staying awake. You've got no idea when the enemy's going to come through. There was another stage. We were waiting to go into ambush position, and it was come sunset, and we were going to go into ambush position then. We sent out a clearing patrol, which is a couple of men go out around 30 metres around you where you camped to make sure everything's clear. And then afterwards, while we were sitting there, heard speaking coming along this track. And it wasn't until they got right up close that we realised it was a Viet Cong. So that was come as a surprise to us, come as the biggest surprise to them. They took off, and we stayed where we were and fired at them, of course, and never checked it out till the next morning. We never moved. You hear everything and your mind goes on high alert. Even if it's a cricket chirping, you go on high alert straight away. It's strange. And when you come home, you don't sleep. Right. When you go back to camp, you sleep, but when you come home to your home life, you don't sleep because you're listening to all those sounds all the time.
And is there any issues with your hearing?
I'm now fairly deaf, whether it was from army-related or work-related, because I worked in heavy industry and there was a lot of noise there. But also with the artillery and the our live rounds and that could have affected it as well. Yeah, I'm deaf in both ears. You're on high alert from the time you leave your base camp to the time you get back. There's no relaxing time, because once you stop, you're more or less getting your meal ready, have your ration pack and setting up a tent to sleep that night. Or setting up positions if you're going into an ambush and that. But you're always doing things. You're more or less on alert 24 hours a day when you add on operations.
Could you talk me through a typical day?
You'd leave camp, usually in platoon strength, unless you're going on a major operation when it would be company strength. And you'd leave as soon as you go into the jungle, or into outside the camp, you're, as we said, high alert. You're ready to come under fire at any stage. And you could walk, or whatever you want to call it, for hours until you get to the position where you're ready to do it. In our position, as 5RA, when we first got there, because Nui Dat was nothing there, except for Nui Dat, which in English means little hill, we had a mission of 5,000 metre circumference around Nui Dat that we had to clear. And we were out. Our first operation, I think, lasted just about 3 months. We were more or less in, out all the time for 3 months on operations. And we had more or less no downtime. I think I was the first to go on R&R. They thought I was getting a bit jumpy and talking in my sleep a bit. And that's how they sent me on R&R. I had the luck to end up in Hong Kong for 4 days, and that while the others were out, still out on operations.
And how did you feel being in civilization like that when?
Strange. They go about things every day, normal day operations. They're out carefree, everything else like that, and we're still on operation. We're still more or less operation mode. And that because we've been working for so long clearing the perimeters. I try to put it off my mind, out of my mind, but I have a hard time these days because I'm the curator of the museum. And being down here, you relive things more often than what sometimes you'd wish for and that. But other than that, when I first come home, I'm more or less switched off completely. Of army and that, tried to drink myself out of it, which I think you'll find most veterans did do when they returned home, drunk. Not drunk, but drank a lot. And it took several years before I stopped drinking, and that because that was the one way I could get to sleep. And I think you'll find most other people felt the same way. And to relax, all you had to relax with was a cigarette in those days. Rollies or tailor-made cigarettes. And the army more or less encouraged you to smoke to help you relax.
De-stress, yeah. Was there much access to alcohol when you were in Vietnam?
We had a choice of either having so many a night or let it all go and that and just drink it. And if we couldn't get any, we had none. And that, so we had either choice. We chose that while we were in camp, we'd have it. And if we couldn't get it, we'd go without. And I've got to say, sometimes, even though we were in camp, we had too much. And that because it was the only time at night time you could relax. And that, and when I say relax, we were still circled with barbed wire. So wherever you went, you took your rifle with you and that. You could say we were on alert for 12 months of the year because when we come back in camp, we had barbed wire around us all the time. And wherever we walked with our rifle and that. So
how much sleep would you get on a... on average?
Couldn't tell you now.
Like
out on ops, not much.
3 hours?
Oh, probably more than that, 4 or 5 hours, off and on. Because you'd have to go on sentry duty as well, or guard duty, whatever you want to call it. And you'd be crawling around in the dark, getting there to relieve someone. So you'd have broken sleep during the night. And once again, you'd wake up if you heard a noise.
That sounds pretty tough.
It was.
What gave you strength?
Youth. And that was it, I think. You just done what you had to do. And if it was hard, it was hard. We were all young. And I don't know, we all got through it okay. It was afterwards that we had trouble in our afterlife.
Were you aware or did you feel that your approach to how you acted changed the closer you got to the end of your term?
I think you become more careful. You probably made yourself more in danger by becoming more careful. Does that make sense?
I think so, yeah.
Because you're getting close to your time and you're going home and you're going out on operations, you're walking very carefully and hoping you don't meet anyone. We were told we had to identify ourselves before anything, before we fired. You don't do that. We were told that before we left Australia and everything else like that, but you don't do that because it becomes self-survival and that, and you fire before they fire at you.
You know,
if a scout sees them, you would drop to the ground and signal to your troops behind that there's enemy. And from there, if the enemy hasn't seen you, the boss of the platoon, it's usually the lieutenant, he makes plans from there for you to engage. But if they see you and they're going to fire, you fire straight away yourself. Yeah.
Which would be more often the case.
Yes, probably. You'd see them and they'd see you, 90% of the time. We come against tunnels up to it, but infantry, they say infantry aren't smart. We're smart. We gave it to the engineers to go down. We passed it over to them. Some of our guys did do it, but yes, there's tunnels there, and if there was a tunnel there, it had to be inspected, whether it be us or engineers. If we were smart, we'd give it to the engineers.
Did you go down any tunnels?
I never went down any, no.
That would be quite terrifying, I imagine.
I couldn't even imagine it because you heard how they had snakes down there and booby traps on the sides of the tunnels and things like that. You heard these things and I would not want to be the one that had to go down there. Anybody that was crook afterwards, I could fully understand it. Quite often you'd come across, in a village, there's quite often tunnels in a village, and that everywhere. Because a lot of the villagers They're friends during the day, an enemy at night. And if you raid the village, some of the Viet Cong would be down the tunnels and away, hiding in there, and there'd be the wives or the old people there acting innocent. And say act innocent, they had to, because even if they didn't like the Viet Cong, they would have been shot. Because if you don't like them, you're an enemy, and they would have shot you. And that, anyway, so there was no choice. You had to look after them. We were on our own.
You were by yourself.
We were on our own. When we first got to Nui Dat, there was a battalion of US soldiers, and they were across the road, and they'd got there before us, but once we'd settled into a certain stage, they packed up and left, and we were on our own from then on.
And did you have much to do with them?
I had nothing to do with them, but others did, a little bit. When they went out on operations or something like that, we'd go over and steal all their grids from around their tents so we could put them around ours. Because we had our tents, we had to dig trenches all the way around because when it rained, and you had to cover them with these grids, so we kind of borrowed theirs.
And how much rain was there?
Well, we used to have to dig 12 by 12 trenches around the tents, and when it rained, they weren't big enough, and they'd just come in under the water, just come in under the floorboards. When we got there, all we had was four-man tents. That was in Nui Dat itself, and that... And as I said, 5RA was the first battalion there, so we more or less had to clear the area and make things safe for when 6RA come. 6RA come in July, I think it was, and they'd only been in country for approximately 6 weeks before they were hit and the Battle of Long Tan occurred. And from there on, 5RA were lucky. They were at the concert, the little paddy of Cold Joy were given, and 6RA were out on operations and that. And because the night previous we'd had mortars fired into our camp, and they had to go out and look for where the mortars were fired from, and that. And it all happened out there then. And at night time then, the helicopters weren't allowed to fly because it was couldn't see properly because of the rain, it was that heavy. And that, but two pilots disobeyed orders to fly out ammunition, to drop ammunition down to the soldiers that were out of ammo. But standing orders for chopper pilots, I believe, was in those kind of conditions you don't fly. And that, and well, they disobeyed orders to get ammunition out because they were almost out of ammunition. But they had to break orders to disobey orders to get that ammunition out.
You mentioned there the concert.
Yes.
Could you just talk through that coming up and how did the soldiers feel about having this?
An Australian girl coming with a miniskirt on. Oh, we loved it. Miniskirts in those days were just above the knees. But yeah. We loved it, and Cold Joy was the music in those days. Little Patty, everyone's darling. She was 17 years of age on her first tour of Vietnam, and we loved it. We were very excited. We trooped down to where the concert stand was, and sit there and lean back, or lean squat with our rifles between our legs, and that happened for a while. And as I said to you, when Long Tan started, they grabbed Lil Paddy up and the band up and got them out. They couldn't find Cold Joy. I believe 5RA headquarters had kidnapped him to take him over to the camp. And at night time there, because the helicopters had left and they weren't coming back to pick him up, he was, at night time, he was given a pistol, sat down in a trench and said, told to fire if anyone doesn't identify themselves. And that was his visit to Nui Dat on that trip. He has now become an honorary member of 5RA. Since 2010, I think he became an honorary member.
Roughly.
August the 18th, 1966. That's, as I said to you in the museum, that's the day that they're nominated for Vietnam Veterans Day. because of that battle. They sent got to entertainers to come out and sing to us. And entertainers is the young lady in that was killed over there by the name of Kathy Warnes or Waynes. She was up on the stage singing. She was 19, second tour. She was up on the stage singing and she was shot and killed. An American soldier was tried for the murder, found guilty. 12 months later, he had a retrial because he always declared he was innocent and he got off. So it's an unsolved murder over there. She was 19, second tour. She was saving money. She thought this was a good way to save money for her and her fiancé to get married. I think there's always stories in there about what happened and that, but in our platoon we had a boxing ring. Instead of having a fight outside if you disagreed with someone, in the boxing ring with gloves on.
And was that a regular occurrence?
It happened a few times, yes, especially after being to the canteen that night and had a few tipples. But that did happen, yes. I've been in a few and I've lost a few. Just about as many as I've been in, I think. As a fighter, I'm a great lover.
How did you feel on those final days, knowing that I'm almost on the way home?
They never sent us out on an operation for within 2 or 3 weeks of us coming home. We were out on an operation and we were sent back. And we were very happy about that too. We had a walk back, or, you know, on patrol type situation back, but the whole company, it was 2 battalions involved. Five Rav was more or less put in the rear to go back and protect the task force. It was the only ride I'd had on a Chinook. Was the day they said, come on boys, load up. And they took us out to the HMS Sydney to go home. And I reckon that was the best day of that 12 months.
So your face lit up there when you mentioned about getting onto that helicopter and being taken out to the HMS Sydney.
Yes.
Yeah. So could you just elaborate a little bit more on that moment?
How you first... You're relaxed, full stop. Just drooped, fell down, but you're totally relaxed once you're on that Sydney. It was unreal feeling and that. And it's a funny story there. We were coming home. Well, I think it's funny, maybe I've got a sick sense of humour. We were coming home and a force 5 gale or wind come up, and every soldier or every person on board was given a 26-ounce can of beer. And even if you didn't drink, you took the can for someone else. Well, they'd had a lot, and you could find your way to the heads by just following the sickness. Because the boat was rocking and rolling, and people couldn't handle it. I drank one. I never drank any more, but... I wasn't sick either because I'd been out fishing that many times here that you're used to the rock and roll.
So the HMAS Sydney brought you back down the coastline?
Down the coastline to Sydney.
To Sydney. Do you remember pulling into the harbour?
Yes. And
how did that feel? What was
going through your mind? We're home. Oh, joy. I can't say the words in what we really said, but yeah, oh joy. We got to march through Sydney. We had a ticker tape parade all through the main street of Sydney. And 12 months later, that changed because there was that many protesters and everything else. But every battalion that come home marched through the hometown or home city. And we had an absolute brilliant welcome home. And afterwards, it all changed. That was the second time we'd got to march through Sydney. We had to do a month's tour of New Guinea, which I forgot to mention.
Okay, yep.
Our company went to New Guinea. It was a goodwill tour. And went around the mountains and that. We flew up to Port Moresby, then over to the Owen Stanley. We went up there in I think it was a Qantas jet. Went from the Owen Stanley over to Marprick, which is in the Central Highlands, in a caribou. Went around for a month, close to a month, I think it was, and to all these villages and everything, given a great welcome everywhere. That was a strange time too, because of seeing how other people live. And then we come back, marched into Wee-Wak, where we were given overnight or night leave for a couple of hours. We won't go into that one. And then we were shipped out to the Sydney and come home to Sydney then, as well on the Sydney. So that was in December 65. I forgot to put that in. But that was a good trip. It made you aware of what tropics were really like. When we, of course, it was all relaxed because it wasn't war footing or anything else like that. We used to joke that we could take our clothes off and stand them in the corner of the tent because they were that stiff with sweat because you really perspired. It was something unreal. From the time you started walking to the time you finished that day, you just one drenched in sweat. You had no choice. It was life. Life as we knew it back then. Cigarettes we were allowed to have.
While you were on patrol?
Yes. Which, when you think of it, was stupid. Because if you're not allowed to have soap or anything else like that, you're allowed to have cigarettes. And if you smoke tobacco, you used to smoke drum a lot. Drum was the in thing in those days, which smelt. Cigarette smelt. So that was stupid.
Mm, you smell it from a long distance. Yeah.
Yeah, and then cooking, they used to say the hexi cubes, they don't give off smell and they don't give off smoke. But it's a real bright flame. And if you cooked at night time, so everything contradicted each other and that. But you never thought of that at that time. No. I do this quite often with kids, high school kids. They come, we give them a tour. There's only two of us that went to Vietnam, and one of them doesn't talk about it. Mm-hmm. So it's left up to me, and I think kids deserve to know what our history is. And that's part of our history, whether it be good history or bad history. It's history.
Jeff Kenyon, thank you so much for sharing your stories with me for this program, the RSL Time to Celebrate. Mm. Thank you for the amazing work you do here at Museum. It's absolutely fantastic. And I'm going to tell the world to come to Port Pirie and come
Thank
and
you.
Visit the museum.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
You have been listening to the RSL, A Time to Celebrate, 2020.